Welcome to tonight's event. My name is Stefan Hertog. I'm an associate professor at the Department of Government. I've got a capacious list of instructions for chairing this event. What we're going to do is talk about the new book, How Sanctions Work, by Nargis Bajoli, who is here with us. Valinas is also here with us. Javad Salisi Isfahani, who's not with us. I think he's in Virginia right now. And Ali Weiss, who's probably also somewhere in the United States at this point. The running order is going to be that we're not going to have a long upfront presentation. Instead, we'll have sort of an interactive debate here that I'll kick off with a question, and then we'll have Sanam, our discussant, coming in with a couple of questions. And after sort of 40 to 50 minutes of back and forth on stage, we'll open it up for Q&A. In total, we got a little bit less than 1.5 hours. I have to remind you, I'm contractually obliged to remind you of a couple of things. First of all, this event is being held in accordance with the LSE's Code of Practice and Free Speech, which protects and promotes freedom of speech and academic freedom. We intend for this to be an engaging discussion on the book and the topic of Iran and the role of economic sanctions, and there'll be ample time during the Q&A for further discussion. Obviously, you know, we want a lively discussion, but we want to keep things civil. This event, importantly, will be recorded. We aim to make a podcast recording of the event available, so if you're speaking, then be aware that this might be recorded for posterity. We will be taking photos during the event, and most importantly, there will be copies of the book available to purchase after the event outside. So you all need to get a copy of the book, and that's provided by the Gilded Acorn Bookshop. And then, yeah, we'll get to the Q&A details later. I'll just give you a very quick overview of who's speaking to you tonight. So first of all, we got Nargis Bajoli, who is Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins SAIS in DC. She's an award-winning anthropologist, scholar, and filmmaker. Her first book, Iran Reframed, Anxieties of Power in the Islamic Republic, which I believe is about the Republican Guard, is that correct? The Revolutionary Guard. Iran. So got my guards confused there. That book received the 2020 Margaret Mead Award, the 2020 Choice Award for Outstanding Academic Title, and the 2021 Silver Medal in Independent Publisher Book Awards. She's also obviously the co-author of this great book. We've got as our next speaker, Vali Nasser, who is the Majid Khaduri Professor of International Affairs and Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins SAIS. A non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center, among other things. He was also dean of Johns Hopkins SAIS. He was also senior advisor in the US government from 2009 to 2011. And he's the author of many books. I just mentioned two of them. One is The Dispensable Nation, American Foreign Policy in Retreat. And the other one is The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. And he is obviously also a co-author of this volume. And finally, our discussant, Sanam Vakil, is the director of the Middle East North Africa program at Chatham House. She's led project work on Iran and Gulf Arab dynamics there. Her research focuses on regional security, Gulf geopolitics, and on future trends in Iran's domestic and foreign policy. She's also the James Anderson Professorial Lecturer at the Johns Hopkins SAIS campus in Europe in Bologna, so it's a Johns Hopkins SAIS panel today, and she's the author of Action and Reaction, Women and Politics in Iran, which was published in 2013. I want to say just something for 30 seconds about this great book, which is really, I think, put together by sort of an Iran dream team. So you got the full range from deeply qualitative anthropology via political science to hardcore quantitative economics in the case of Javad Salih Isfahani. So it's a very, very wide range of expertise that has gone into writing that. Really a very unusual range of expertise. I don't think you actually have anthropologists and economists working together that much. It's a book that covers an issue that's really greatly under researched, both in its own right in terms of the Iranian case and the impact of sanctions, but also more broadly in terms of international relations theory and the broader question about efficacy and reversibility of sanctions. And I think it provides great insights on both of those accounts. I think what I found particularly striking, and this is the only substantive thing I'll potentially say today, is the historical background on sanctions and how after World War I you describe they were meant to be used as sort of as a threat that would actually never be implemented in practice. And authors at the time were very upfront about the horrendous consequences that actually implemented economic sanction on countries would have for civilian populations, which are really equivalent to, you know, warfare on the civilian population. And at the time, the discourse about sanctions was, in a sense, much more honest and much more frank, but tied to the hope that because they were so devastating, they would never have to be used. Whereas now we're living in a world where they're used all of the time, but very few people are actually honest about their devastating consequences. So I thought that that was a very interesting and instructive historical contrast. But I think I wanted to perhaps start you off with one question, and you know, feel free to, after that, you know, elaborate on other themes of the book that you might want to say something about. And that is the story that you tell about US sanctions to some extent help you to build a broader argument about why sanctions in general are irreversible or they're inefficient. They turn the target nation against the sanctioning nation. They impoverish populations. They're ineffective as a diplomatic tool. But that is also made with the specific instance of sanctions under Trump. And you could argue that perhaps sanctions in general are a different kettle of fish from sanctions under Trump. So you could think of the Trump maximum pressure sanctions as particularly blunt, particularly badly implemented, particularly kind of domestically driven sanctions, and that in sort of a counterfactual world where Hillary had won the election, the JCPOA, so the nuclear freeze deal between the Western powers and Iran had stayed in place, and at least partial sanctions relief as part of that deal had continued, in that counterfactual world, perhaps you could tell a story that, you know, sanctions have loads of problems, but in that particular instance, perhaps they did actually get to a certain result. And the fact that we're in such a terrible place now is much more because of domestic dynamics in the United States and because, quote unquote, the wrong person won the presidential election. So perhaps if you could tease out a bit sort of the specificities of your case where sort of Iran was just unlucky to be exposed to Trump, from the broader argument that kind of sanctions are very limited in their efficacy in general. I think that could be interesting.
Sure. So first of all, thank you so much for everyone for being here. Thanks to LSE. Can you all hear us okay? Yeah, thanks to LSE for hosting us. Thank you to Stefan and Sanam for being here and being our discussants. So when we began to think of this book and do the research for this book, obviously it was happening under the Trump maximum pressure sanctions, as you rightly point out, but it was also about sort of more broadly sanctions in the United States. By the US Department of Treasury's own accounting, US sanctions have increased by over 900% since the start of the 21st century. So that means that, and the Washington Post just did some recent reporting that over one third of the countries in the world are under some form of US sanctions or another. Most of them tend to be poorer countries. So, you know, sitting in Washington, watching all of this unfold, one of the things that became important to us was that this was a tool that was being used almost sort of like a knee-jerk reaction. Anytime some kind of foreign policy dilemma would come up in Washington, the answer was, let's start to apply sanctions. And when we began to look at the literature, not only just on Iran, but sort of any other sanctioned country, we began to realize that there just wasn't much language to talk about sanctions. What do sanctions do? Do they do what they say that they are supposed to do? Do they actually get to the policy implications of what they are set out to do, or do they not? And we began a series of studies at Johns Hopkins sites with over a dozen scholars to begin to look specifically from the perspective of a targeted nation. Because a lot, those of you who are IR scholars or students of IR in the room know that a lot of studies of sanctions tend to be done from an IR perspective. And so they're either looking at it in an abstract formulation or they're done from a macroeconomic perspective. But we have very, very little knowledge from the perspective of a targeted nation about what is it that sanctions actually do from the perspective of folks living on the ground, those in the political elite, those in the military elite, right? So what is it that sanctions are actually doing in a targeted nation? And I'm going to get to some of the more specifics of your question, but just sort of more broadly, after we did this research and published this book, then we started a whole nother series of research projects through our initiative at SAIS, which is to look at, okay, we figured out in some ways, or we began to sort of figure out the Iran case, but is that just specific to Iran, or do sanctions function that way or differently in other countries around the world? And now we're working with over a dozen other researchers looking at cases from Zimbabwe to Cuba to Russia to North Korea to, you know, basically everywhere else that has been sanctioned by the United States. And we're finding very, very similar trends. So, and not all of them were under Trump maximum pressure sanctions. So what is it that sanctions do more broadly, right? Sanctions are supposed to do one of two things. They're either supposed to put enough economic pressure on a state to force that state to change its behavior, or put enough pressure on a targeted society to force the targeted society to rise up, to then force the state to make some changes or to lead to some kind of regime change, right? These are sort of the logics by which economic sanctions are supposed to work. However, when you begin to look from the perspective of a targeted society and a targeted state, there are a few things that you begin to see. One is that, again, we'll talk specifically about Iran, but we're seeing this trend play out in all of the different targeted societies, which is that when you put economic sanctions on a state, first of all, you're dealing with states, for the most part, that in their political culture, they see the United States or Western powers as either bullying them or being imperialistic, or however it is that they sort of rhetorically talk about it. So these countries, these states, are not going to put their hands up and say, oh my God, the United States, I'm so sorry, I'm coming to the table. Let me make you like me again, right? These are not Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, Russia. Those are not, the political cultures of those states is not that. So then the other part of it is that what is it doing to the civilian population? And the things that we find is that under sanctions, and you can draw this out when you look at the economic data as well as the sociological and anthropological data, is that sanctions over time make the targeted population increasingly poorer, especially the middle classes, because of inflation that are very specifically targeted and sort of triggered by sanctions. And at the same time, the targeted state, and especially its military apparatuses and the businesses tied to the military apparatuses, become exponentially wealthier over time. Why is that? It goes back to the first problem, which is that states under sanctions don't put their hands up in the air and say, we're so sorry, we're going to come to the table. Instead, they say, we're going to bust through your sanctions. Right? We're going to figure out ways to evade these sanctions. How do states bust through sanctions? First of all, they figure out ways to, trade becomes illegal pretty much, or extremely expensive on the international market when you're under sanctions. Insurance companies don't want to insure the goods. Banks will not do business with you. So you have to figure out ways to get goods in and out of your country, which means that you go on to the black and gray markets. You start to kind of, the political economy of the state begins to function like a drug cartel in many ways, right? So you go into a black and gray market, and then that means you're paying exponentially higher prices for those same goods that maybe before sanctions you were paying X amount, now you're paying 4 times, 5 times, 20 times as much as what you had to pay. So in that process, independent businesses get iced out of the market. They just simply, over time, do not have access to capital to be able to engage in those kinds of drawn up prices. Second of all, because of how dangerous and illegal it is to do trade on these kinds of markets, you end up not only, again, icing out independent businesses, but also the only ones who are willing to take the risk and have enough capital to be able to do this kind of trade are the businesses that are tied to the political and military establishments. So then, and then everything is happening in cash. Right? Because again, you're dealing in the black and gray markets. So their wealth begins to exponentially go up because you're also dealing with, once you're doing sanction or once you're trading on the black and gray markets, corruption increases even more than what was there before. And that cash then comes into the country and needs to be washed. And this is why over time in any kind of sanctioned country that you look at, you begin to have an upswing of luxury. And that luxury is tied in to those who are tied to the political and military establishments, while at the same time you have a downward trend of the middle classes in particular towards poverty, and then of the poor classes even towards subsistence poverty.
Let me sort of add first of all to let me thank also LSC for inviting us, and also for to Stefan and Sanam, both very good friends and collaborators on many different projects, for agreeing to serve as moderators for this session. I think Nargis very well put the issue of how do policymakers think sanctions work in terms of changing behavior. I just want to add one other one, which is very clear in the case of Iran, which is there's not a great benefit to sanctions as well, which makes policymakers in the West feel good about themselves. It is a case of pretending to do something about a problem that you can't do anything about, or you don't want to do anything about. And there actually sanctions work extremely well. So, you know, Alex Navalny dies in a prison in Siberia, and the United States randomly the next morning puts sanctions on 250 individuals and entities, which have actually nothing to do with Navalny, will have no impact on Russia, but it's basically for the Biden administration to say, we did something, where they can't do anything, or they don't want to do anything further, or they don't see a reason to do anything further. And this is actually goes to, you know, Stefan's original point about, you know, does it make a difference whether it's Trump's maximum sanctions pressure or something else? Yeah, Nargis very well laid out sort of the impact, at least at the initial level, impact on the population, on the country from her anthropological lens. I sort of approached this project a little bit differently, looking at it from the angle of foreign policy making. So, you know, the idea that sanctions have increased by 900% since year 2000 tells you that sanctions are the most important foreign policy tool that the United States, and not only the United States, United Kingdom and Europe have. It is more important than war, it's more important than diplomacy, it's now the single most important foreign policy tool, about which we know very little. So we don't know, does it work? Does it not work? When does it work? I mean, Nargis very well laid out that it does work in completely changing the economy of a country, but it doesn't work, or it works if you're trying to tell your own population that you're standing tall against dictators and their bad behavior, but it does it actually work in ways that it's intended to work, right? Does it actually change behavior of governments? Does it make them behave better? Does it make them stop what they're doing? And I think the case of Iran is pretty important, largely because until maybe Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Iran was the most sanctioned country in the world already, right? And it's the country that perhaps other than North Korea and Cuba has been sanctioned longest, and that the issue of sanctions have been very central to American way of dealing with Iran altogether, right? And so if you're gonna actually look at the efficacy of sanctions, there's no better country to look at other than Iran. And there are two things. One is that you can look at the longitudinal effect of sanctions. What does it mean for a country to be under sanctions for 45 years, right? What does it do to the country? Which is the assumption is that everything that you see in Iran is has nothing to do with the economic situation that Iran lives under, and you know, we found that to be not correct. That yes, Islamic ideology, regime behavior, the people who rule Iran are very important in explaining Iran, but so is also economic sanctions. So you cannot explain the oligarch class in Iran, you cannot explain the distribution of wealth in Iran, you cannot explain many things in Iran, unless you also looked at the economic context in which it works. And so we thought that it's important to sort of document this in the over a 45-year period. But the importance of Trump sanctions is that it is the only time that a country has been so rapidly put under maximum pressure sanctions. Maximum pressure meaning that virtually, you know, everything, every relationship with a leftover of maybe just selling a bit of oil was put on sanctions. So Iran cannot trade with anybody openly, not only with European countries, the United States, but countries other than who want to trade with Iran will be punished for trading with Iran. Companies who want to do business with Iran, if they're in Malaysia, if they're in China, they will be punished. In other words, there is extraterritorial enforcement of sanctions. So the country is isolated from trade. It is kicked out of the financial institutions. No banks can do business with Iran. No financial institutions can do business with Iran. You cannot send money to Iran. You cannot receive money from Iran. Doesn't matter if it's for humanitarian reasons, for whatever reasons. So it's completely sort of cut off. And so that it's the interesting question that comes up is not only that whether Iran was lucky or unlucky to be stuck with Trump. I mean, there were many among opposition to the Islamic Republic who thought that actually maximum pressure is really good because it's going to break down the regime. So we found out that the shock factor of all of a sudden putting sanctions, which is the first time that's happened to a country, actually didn't work. Increasing sanctions drastically, it didn't work. So when maximum pressure was put on Iran, the argument was that they will, President Trump's argument was that they will come back to the nuclear negotiating table on their knees. He actually told European diplomats who were very worried, Secretary Pompeo did, that don't worry, Iran, don't worry about the consequences. Iran will be on its knees begging for a new deal in 6 months. Not only that didn't happen, but Iran actually went to 60% enriched uranium, now 90% enriched uranium. The director of the CIA said 2 weeks ago that Iran is within a week of having enough fissile material for a single bomb, and after that it's a matter of 2 months before it has a first weapon, right? And even if you went back to the Iran nuclear deal under the best circumstances and Iran observed everything, at best Iran would be 6 weeks away from a nuclear material, right? Whereas under the nuclear deal it was 2 years away. So all that the maximum pressure achieved was actually accelerate Iran's move towards nuclear capability. When President Trump came out of the nuclear deal in 2020, the weight of the Iran's low enriched uranium, that's only a 3.5% enriched uranium, was the same weight as that of the President of the United States. They weighed the same. Now Iran has multiple of that in 20% enriched uranium, and the weight of Iran's 60% enriched uranium probably approximates President Trump's weight, right? And Iran has in the order of tons of low enriched uranium. So, you know, in every way, Iran's nuclear program has progressed thanks to the sanctions. Maybe many people think there's no difference between shades of gray in Iran, but at closer examination, Iran's economy has been more securitized. The Revolutionary Guards have taken over virtually every aspect of Iranian society, economy, under the conditions that Narges mentioned, that the hard line became, took control of Iran's foreign policy, of domestic policy, with catastrophic reasons. 20% of Iran's middle class since 2020 has fallen below the poverty belt, right? 80% of Iranians today rely on some form of government handout in order to make ends meet at the end. And so there was no coming back to the table to give in. The regime didn't fall as was expected. Iran became more aggressive regionally. Just look since October 7th. By America's own standards, Iran is more powerful in the Middle East than it was before, is more influential, and is the source, quote unquote, of all the problems. right? And Israel has identified it as such. So that didn't change. In fact, it became more. And Iranian missile capabilities, drone capabilities have actually accelerated, right? So it was important to sort of hold the case of Iran as a mirror to the basically American foreign policy, European foreign policy, and English British foreign policy, that you use this tool as if it's a solution to your problems. Not only it's not a solution, but it's actually a force multiplier in the opposite direction. So what the Trump sanctions tell you is that the more of it you use, the more aggressively you use it, the more is actually the boomerang effect. It's not that Iran is standing still. Iran has become far worse, right? Without a clear solution, because there's no more sanctions left to impose that would actually be meaningful. And so it was important to look at this, because it's not only about Iran. The United States and Europe are following the same policy with Russia that they followed with Iran, which is sanction after sanction after sanction. And if the result with Iran only between 2020 and 2024 is what we see, then this is what you should expect of what you will see with Russia 5 years from now, right? So your expectation, it's about setting the expectations for academics who work on this, and setting the expectation for foreign policymakers. It's not about whether you're dealing with good regimes or bad regimes or what other alternatives you have. That's the wrong way of asking a question. It's kind of like saying, you know, you have cancer, you can do this surgery or that surgery. And if I don't do this, you have to look at what is the effectiveness of what you're doing. And the case of Iran is very important in that regard. And so sort of doing those papers, which we were lucky to be able to do, to actually look at the actual impact, and then on this side, look at, you know, what the policy has achieved in the foreign policy arena, was very key. And in that sense, the Trump sanctions were very, very important. But the Trump sanctions also underscore something else, which is they underscored that sanctions as a tool of foreign policy will never get lifted, period. You know, with war, you at some point you have a ceasefire. You say, I'm going to stop shooting, right? And then there's a ceasefire, and the ceasefire terms. There is no such thing with sanctions. So agree or not agree, there was a nuclear deal in 2015. The reason that the U.S. went out of it and imposed sanctions was not because there was a violation of the original deal. It was because it decided it can have a better deal. Right? And it can basically renegotiate by increasing sanctions. Right? But looked at the other way, if you're looking at sitting in Moscow or Pyongyang or China and looking at what happened with Iran nuclear deal, your understanding would be that sanctions would never get lifted. And then the longer they stay, and if that's your assumption on the other side, that you're going to be living under sanctions forever, then the calculations would become very different. It becomes about how I survive sanctions, not about how do I satisfy the United States to get out of sanctions. Because the assumption of all, not only in Tehran, but in all these capitals, is that Iran did satisfy the United States to some extent, right? But the result was not reduction of sanctions, but actually a drastic escalation in sanctions. And if that's the case, then it's kind of like one side is playing chess, the other side will be playing a completely different game.
Great, thanks. Salam, I think you got some questions up your sleeve.
Sure, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I think it's a real opportunity to be discussing this timely book, because as Narges and Vali have mentioned, Iran is a case study for a growing policy response that is low cost. I signed up for sort of alerts for sanctions from the US government, UK government, and I'm not kidding, every Friday I get hit in my inbox with the OFAC sanctions that come every week on, you know, which country you have to see, but it seems like it's a weekly thing. More and more sanctions, and I've even given up tracking who's being sanctioned because, you know, they just keep coming. And So I just wanted to point out a few things that I thought were really important about the book, probably echoing what you've already said, and of course I have a couple of questions for you. And we're doing a lot of work on this as well at Chatham House, really echoing the same sort of case study approach of how sanctions and the impact of sanctions are bearing out in similar ways in Cuba, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, you know, eventually Syria, if you can really analyze it, Yemen, you know, and I think it's important for us to reflect on the impact of sanctions again, because policymakers are turning to sanctions and using sanctions as a quick, effective response that can show publics and democracies that they're doing something, even when the outcome doesn't really lead to meaningful change. But in the case of Iran, I think three themes really jumped out at me. And it's something that resonates with a lot of my work in sort of tracking changes in Iran. And one, of course, is looking at the economic impact that both Narges and Vali have spoken to. But of course, the Islamic Republic has long sought to embolden and build out a resistance economy, tried to be more self-sufficient. But you write, and I think it's really well written, that sanctions have forced innovation in Iran. But it's not the sort of innovation that we want to see in Iran, but rather innovation to sanctions bust. And in fact, Iran has made sanctions busting, you know, sort of part of its business now. You know, we hear anecdotally, but also practically, that Iran has offered its sanctions busting services to support other sanctioned countries like Russia. And, you know, of course, this is a serious and adverse effect. And that innovation, of course, in a highly dynamic, very educated society is, of course, really devastating. You mentioned it already, Narges, but I think the capture, the state capture of the private sector and the pushing out of independent businesses is a sort of devastating impact of sanctions in the country. And you hear about this more and more anecdotally in your book. It's rich, the book is rich with quotes that are very important to really shed light on the individual impact of sanctions. And so I really encourage you to try to tap into the human impact, because very oftentimes, and particularly in these days, the human element of policy is very much neglected as we look at states. But it's important to consider that. I think also thinking about how the IRGC has become more influential, has of course captured illicit trade, and then of course used that state capture to build illicit networks beyond Iran to keep itself resilient. And that is playing out in our eyes today with economic ties that extend from Yemen to Syria to Lebanon to Iraq as part of the axis of resistance. And this is a sort of understudied but important dynamic where Israel just the other day bombed Lebanese Hezbollah's banks, you know, with fair warning. So, of course, the assets were withdrawn and the impact again is assumed by you know, ordinary people in Lebanon. So I think this is an important dynamic as well, where sanctions, of course, embed groups into societies and economies, and unraveling the influence is harder. And I think that's really important. Secondly, of course, the humanitarian dimension is urgent and really key to understand. This is critical in Iran, but also in countries like Yemen, where you can't really send money, provide access to food, medicines. And we have tracked at Chatham House how even in economies connected through these illicit markets from Lebanon to Iraq and Syria, how sanctioned economies get lower qualities of pharmaceutical products, for example, or expired pharmaceutical products. So there is a human impact, a nutritional impact that I think is generational. And you know, that, of course, embeds all sorts of sentiments and ideologies that need to be considered. Finally, I think, of course, and I think this might be worthwhile discussing, and perhaps there'll be questions on this, of course, there's the political impact of living under the other side of sanctions, perhaps forcing or trying to encourage, you know, unrest from below and the overhang of regime change that clouds, you know, the Iranian engagement abroad, Iran and its dynamics with its people. It's certainly a state that has a deep legitimacy crisis, but this overhang and fear of regime change, you know, obviously impacts civil society and on and on. And I think that that is also worthwhile bringing out. But my questions for you, and I have about 10, but I'm only going to ask you two. You live in Washington, okay, and everything is about, you know, the next election, and everything, of course, in 2025 is going to very much be connected to Iran. I'm curious how U.S. policymakers have engaged with your book at this time, you know, where you're trying to present a counterfactual about the effectiveness of sanctions, when so many people in the United States think that sanctions were effective in bringing Iran to the table in the first sort of behind the scenes negotiations that then began the long JCPOA process. And is there, and here we are in 2024, the cascade of Iran issues are not shrinking, as you mentioned, Vali, they're growing, right? We have human rights sanctions, we have sanctions on Iran, export of drones and missiles to Russia, we have malign activities in Europe, we have the advancing nuclear program. I mean, I'm sure I'm missing a few, but you know, you get what I'm saying. So what sort of response and reflections are you getting, if any, on the efficacy of sanctions, if, you know, and then of course, how do you address the Iran problem set if sanctions aren't working? You know, what sort of innovative thinking do you have on this big topic that I'm sure everyone wants to hear about?
So I'll let Betty take the policy questions. But the a few things, and thank you, Sanam, for those great comments. One is that sanctions are, as you're saying, first of all, they come out every Friday. OFAC puts out a newsletter, you know, saying these are the new sanctions that are there. If any of you have ever read sanctions documents, and I encourage you to do so, it's almost impossible to understand. And that's on purpose, because they are written by lawyers and by bankers. And they are written to be very vague on purpose for a few reasons. One is that there are anytime lawyers write something, they write it in a way so that it flows like water and you kind of can't put your finger on exactly what it is. That's the job of a lawyer. But also because the vagueness of it actually allows for overcompliance, okay? And I'm gonna get to that question of overcompliance in a second. But all of this to say is that when you, sanctions, they are so abstract and they are difficult to understand, and then their impact on a targeted society is also difficult to pinpoint because you can't see it. Right? Like when you drop a bomb somewhere, you can take a picture. Someone on the ground can take a picture. A photojournalist can take a picture. They can take a video and say, look, this bomb, look at the crater it created. Look at the amount of people that it's killed. Sanctions, as a form of economic statecraft and economic warfare, which I have to sort of open up a parenthesis here to say that not only is it that a targeted state sees sanctions as economic warfare, but policymakers in Washington, and I would say probably here in Europe as well, but I just know the US case much better, they also talk about and write about sanctions as warfare. They, policymakers in the Department of Treasury, when they are talking about and writing about sanctions, they do it in parallel to and sort of say that we are doing the same thing as the Pentagon does, but we are doing it with the banking sector, and they do it with sort of hot warfare, right? So the warfare aspect is something that is experienced both and sort of articulated from the policy angle and on the domestic sort of sphere. Now, it is a very difficult thing to see. So part of what we wanted to do, and to get to answering your question, Sanam, is that we wanted to allow people to see what sanctions do. We needed to give it language because otherwise it's very difficult to understand. So that meant that the first two chapters of the book are very ethnographic, meaning that they focus very much on people, because we needed to give, you know, if it's such a big policy tool, in the United States at least, and in Western Europe, people need to be able to understand what it is that our foreign policy is doing. When you sort of hide it in legalese, then we don't have language. And when you don't have language, then you can't talk about it, right? So part of it was to make that obvious. So yes, people are paying attention now in Washington, and it is becoming much more of a discussion. Now, I also have to preface that by saying that I'm not naive in thinking that it's going to necessarily change the policy. But at the very least, there is now a conversation happening in Washington and in the Department of Treasury about the effectiveness of sanctions, because they realize that they've become addicted to it. They realize that it's actually not leading to the kinds of policy implications that they themselves want from the sanctions. So in 2021, the Biden administration and the Department of Treasury did an overview of their sanctions policy. We now have a whole series of big convenings that we just launched last week at Hopkins on can sanctions be reformed? And we're inviting people from across the political spectrum, those who are sanctions proponents and sanctions policymakers, and those who sort of deal with the humanitarian consequences of them. And we can see both from the people that we've invited as well as the people who come into the audiences that this is now starting to become a hot topic to talk about. And part of that is because we've been concentrating so much on giving people a language for even understanding it. In addition to our book, we've worked with a lot of graphic artists to put out infographics to help people understand. A lot of people don't read anymore. We're dealing with TikTok generations. And so to help to visualize sanctions, and we started working with graphic novelists to put a lot of these stories into graphic novel form. Because if you can't picture sanctions, if you can't photograph it, we have to figure out different ways to visualize what happens to people. That also then goes into sort of a point that you brought up, Sanam, which is on the civil society, which I think is a really important point, and I want to hone in on this before I pass the mic to Vadi to talk about the policy implications of this and what else can be possible. Sanctions, again, like I said, is sort of seen not only as warfare from the policymakers, but from the perspective of targeted states as well. And so when a country especially comes under comprehensive sanctions, like Iran has come under, that means that it is not just about tightening the economy of the country and what comes in and out of the country. It means that there are also policies and implementation of cyber warfare, covert operations, overt operations, media warfare, psychological operations, right? It is sort of hybrid warfare in many different styles. That kind of hybrid warfare, from the perspective of a targeted state, they then begin to respond in kind. And what that means, like any country that is in different forms of hybrid warfare, it is the military establishment that comes to the forefront. And this is why, as we talked about earlier, you have the Revolutionary Guards sort of overtake the political atmosphere of Iran, especially during maximum pressure sanctions. So on the domestic sphere in civil society, yes, it allows for and causes certain kinds of uprisings. We see this in Iran in 2017 and 2018, again in 2022. You see it in Cuba in 2021. You see it in Venezuela also fairly recently. Sanctions do cause a lot of economic pressure and people do rise up from it. But in case after case after case, as sanctions tighten on all of these states, you also see a more severe and militarized crackdown from the state for a multitude of reasons. First of all, these states are authoritarian first and foremost, right? So that, it's not that sanctions are causing them to be authoritarian. But what we do see over and over is that the increase of sanctions, the tightening of sanctions, makes them even more authoritarian, more sort of militaristic and securitized on the domestic sphere, because they do think that they are engaged in a type of warfare that is meant to have regime change happen. And so they do not want to let go of their power, and they then react to all kinds of civil society activity as if it is like something that is being dictated from abroad, right? And so the way that they then engage is increased securitization, on the domestic sphere, increased militarization when it comes to dealing with their domestic society. And a lot of the interviews that I did with activists on the ground was that either they end up in prison, especially over the past few 4 or 5 years, or they are retreating from civil society at the moment and saying that they will come back to it later. It is just too risky to be involved in that kind of work at this moment. So this kind of give and take and the different kinds of responses that they are doing is sort of in response to that. I'll hand it over to you for the policy.
I want to also dovetail on both what Sanam and Nargis said, because it brings to mind, the Nobel Prize was just given to 3 economists who worked on the importance of institutions in defining the long-term prosperity and openness of nations, right? So sanctions, in a way, change the institutional map of countries. The longer they stay, the longer, you know, it's important to note that when sanctions are lifted, and if they're lifted, you're not gonna be facing the country that was there when you imposed sanctions. And that's not only a moral hazard, but it's a reality. When the United States arrived in Iraq in 2003, the middle class that it thought it was gonna be there to take over and bring democracy, a country that has had the lowest infant mortality of the Arab world, highest number of engineers per capita in the Arab world, highest life expectancy of the Arab world, was not there anymore. It wasn't. It was a country of broken, poor people, and the institutional structure of the country had changed. And so that's important. I mean, civil society may think they withdraw and they come back, but it won't be there. I mean, once the private sector that existed in Iran disappeared over the past 4 or 5 years, and you now have a private sector that is completely integrated into the black market and the Revolutionary Guards, that's not going to be undone easily. So, to assume that, you know, there's going to be an uprising in Iran, Iran is going to become a democracy, it basically defies everything I know as a social scientist about institutional maps of countries. And that's important. You know, for foreign policy reason, you permanently change the trajectory of a country's historical development, and you change it in ways that actually the West doesn't want that to be the case. You're not bending history in the direction of democratic capitalism. You're bending the history in a very different direction. And lo and behold, obviously, this is not part of the conversation in Washington. I mean, the simplest argument about what you're going to do with sanctions is that wait till elections, it's the next president's problem, right? Which largely means that it's a very sticky issue, because there are a number of things about sanctions that are very key in the United States in particular. One is that because of everything that Nargis said, that imposing sanctions goes also with vilifying and demonizing the other side to justify what you are doing, it becomes extremely difficult to lift it, right? So the immediate argument is that if you lift a sanction on Iran, that money is going to go directly to Beirut, to Hezbollah, right? Or how could you be lifting sanctions on terrorists? You're subsidizing terrorism. There are no American presidents, at least in recent time, that has been willing to actually stand up to this argument. Obama did it virtually by actually giving Iran cash that it was Iran's own money, trying to go around the banking system, which was under sanctions, just give them their money. And that became a huge rallying cry for Republicans during the elections that he had given money. Even after October 7th, you know, Iran made a deal with the United States that $6 billion of its money would be held in Qatar in escrow by the Qatari government. And Iran actually could only use this money by buying something abroad. And then the company that Iran bought something from, which had to be humanitarian, would submit the receipt to the Qataris and get paid by the Qataris. So the money technically would never be going through Iran, right? And none of the money had been spent. None of the $6 billion had actually been spent. And yet on October 8th, the argument in America was that it's that $6 billion that paid for October 7th, right? And in that kind of a popular environment, politicians don't want to lift sanctions. So you know, Iran and Russia, obviously, are, it's much more difficult to do it with them, and particularly with Iran, particularly given where it is in the war with Israel and that environment. So, so that's a reality. I mean, it's not gonna change. So, you know, we're not blasé about sanctions lifting, but we actually think that also, at some point, it's like trying to argue about climate 20 years ago. You're obviously shouting at the mountain, but you have to do it nevertheless. But because the argument has to be out there. There are also a number of other arguments that are coming to the fore. One is that there are those in the United States who think that the overuse of sanctions is actually bringing forward the day that the dollar is going to lose its supremacy, right? That there are more and more countries that are looking for ways to actually go around the dollar. Some of them are forward thinking. In other words, if you're China and you're looking at what happened to Russia and you have a Taiwan issue, you will from now try to find ways to go around the SWIFT financial mechanism or through the dollar. We're not there yet, but all of these countries are not putting an effort into trying to go around that. There's going to be a point that even UK and Europe are going to try to find ways to go around the dollar to do business with China, right? If it's an important enough set of relationships that you and you can't use the dollar because the US has that ability to stop it, you have to find ways to make this trade in another way. So they are criticizing sanctions from that angle. There are those who are arguing that by sanctioning multiple large countries all at the same time, that is Russia, China, Iran, particularly that they are contiguous Eurasian sphere, you're actually, it's different from sanctioning one country only. That if a third of the world is sanctioned and increasingly very large countries are sanctioned, that not only that they will find ways to survive as a group, but also that they can develop technologies and ways of doing business and trade that actually will make them much more resilient and enable them to survive, right? So there is a reason why the Chinese are providing the Russians with the technological tools that they need, that the Russians are investing in trade, creating north-south trade routes through Iran to get to the Persian Gulf, right? And so there is an argument that ultimately sanctions will hit a dead end, and the sooner the United States realizes this, it is better. But you know, part of what we are also arguing is that if you bought our argument and you looked at this and said, okay, you know, you cannot keep adding sanctions, right? There's no more room to add sanctions, like. For instance, when the Mahsa Amini, the women's uprisings happened in Iran, there's a lot of argument, particularly by opposition Iranians, that you should sanction them more. But in reality, there's no more sanctions to put. There's none left. Like you put all of it on the table under maximum pressure to get them to the nuclear negotiating table. So you don't have much left. So we're arriving at that same point with Russia as well. There's not much more that you can put on the table that you haven't already done. So the only thing that becomes material is actually sanction lifting, right? If you put sanctions on somebody for bad behavior, and then there is no expiration date on lifting it, and your only argument is that I may put more sanctions on you, okay, maybe they won't do the next step, but it doesn't stop them from doing what they're doing right now because there's no incentive in stopping. Right? You put sanctions on them for violating X. Okay, they violated it, but there is no provision under which that sanctions get lifted because it's too politically problematic for the American president to say, I'm lifting it, right? So you have to basically, yes, they may not go any further, but they're not going to come back either. The only way you're going to get them to come back is if you put sanctions lifting on the table. So, and the case of the Iran nuclear deal, whether the deal was good or bad, is one argument. But the fact that the deal was actually signed, that Iran came, negotiated, signed the deal first time with the United States and implemented it, was because the U.S. put sanctions lifting on the table. Now, everybody's convinced that probably they wouldn't have lifted, they may have reimposed it. But the Iranians trusted the process. They gave in their nuclear site for sanctions lifting. So part of the argument is that you have to, you know, sanctions are, you can say, okay, we have to keep sanctions there, but the only way this is going to work is that if you actually create ways in which you can lift sanctions. And believe it or not, the United States actually does not have mechanisms for lifting sanctions. It just cannot do it. You know, it's not up to the president necessarily to do it. Congress has ways to weigh in, unlike war. They can basically declare war on sanctions on their own. They can impose their own sanctions. Because of the vagueness of these languages that have been built in it, it's not easy to rescind it. There's no actual process by which you can easily lift sanctions. So there is, you don't have even the facility you have with war that I'm going to stop bombing if you don't do this. The U.S. cannot stop doing that. So partly the argument is that the United States now has to look, or Europeans have to look beyond how well they can impose sanctions, to actually also understand how they can use the sanctions lifting as a bargaining chip to get people to the table.
Great, thanks. So with apologies to Sanam and your second question, we're a bit short on the Q&A, so I think we should move to that bit. So if you'd like to raise your hands if you have a question. Perhaps we collect a couple at a time. I urge you to be very, very concise, but still briefly state who you are at the outset. I suggest we take three at a time, and then we'll get very crisp answers from the panel. And I'll just randomly start on the right side with the lady in blue here.
Hi, my name is Aisha. I'm a master's student here at LSE in the Media and Communications Department. So you mentioned that it is discussed in Washington about reforming the sanctions, and also you mentioned the overuse of sanctions. So my question is, I'm curious to know, what is the threshold of sanctions becoming economic warfare? So is there a consensus by the global bodies that we could say that, okay, to this extent, it won't have tremendous everyday effects on the citizens of that country? Or is it possible to not to overuse sanctions or not to turn them into economic warfare? Thank you.
Great, thank you. If you just put your arms up again, I'll take a few more notes. Just the lady right next. So there will be people who will not be able to ask their question. I already apologize about that.
Hello.
I think you have to speak pretty strongly.
All right, I'll try that. Hi, everyone. My name is Maria. I'm an LSE alum. My question is just with regards to the BRICS summit. As you all know, the BRICS summit is happening this week in Moscow, and Pezeshkian is already there. My question was, what do you think this event is likely to achieve?
Great, so we've got space for one more. Let's just continue in this row with, I'll get to the back hopefully in a bit.
Hi, thank you. I'm Zainab Nikukar. I'm master's student at Institute for the Study of Muslim Civilizations at Aga Khan University in London. Given that US sanctions has been imposed on Iran for decades, is it possible to say that sanctions have been ineffective considering Iran's response to sanctions? Because no matter we agree with the ideology of the Islamic Republic of Iran, sanctions are somehow a war tool that used to threaten the security of a country. So as a response, the state can somehow counterbalance that sanction. So are they fundamentally ineffective in some way? And my second question is that regarding Dr. Ali Nasr's comments, do you believe that Iran has been self-reliant enough and has formed a strong alliance with other non-Western countries that they can go on and continue with without lifting the sanctions or not? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, really quick on the, is it possible not to overuse sanctions and make it economic warfare? So in when you listen to policymakers or sort of proponents of sanctions, they'll say there's a difference between comprehensive sanctions and targeted sanctions, or sanctions for human rights violations, or sectorial sanctions. There are all these different like markers and categories when it comes to sanctions, okay? And a lot of times folks will argue that if you do targeted sanctions, it's not the same, it will not be economic warfare because it will not lead to comprehensive sanctions. This is something that you hear often about. And I was really curious about this question actually, and I wanted to sort of see, is that the case or not the case? So when we began to work with scholars of other countries, other sanctioned countries, this sort of, we were really clear on picking spaces that were under targeted sanctions. And so, for example, South Sudan is one of those where it's the activists on the ground after the genocide who were calling for sanctions, who were saying, we want sanctions to be imposed on these leaders or these sort of folks of the military and militias for doing the genocide against us, right? And in that kind of realm and in that kind of rhetorical space, sanctions seem to make sense. You know, you have a civil society folks who are saying there are all of these human rights violations. We need to impose sanctions in a targeted way on these people. But the scholars who work on South Sudan have come to see that actually, because of this question of overcompliance of sanctions, and because, again, sanctions have been increased by 900% since the 21st century, what that means in practice is that every major bank and multinational corporation has risk compliance officers in them now. It's an entire industry, okay? So sanctions have created an entire industry within the business world where you have lawyers especially sitting there and are looking through all of the transactions and saying, well, we have to be careful with this country because they are under some form of US sanctions, and the risk of trading with them means that we could potentially open ourselves up to some penalties from the United States. So even in cases of targeted sanctions, like in the South Sudanese case, in practice, they end up functioning exactly like comprehensive economic sanctions. And this is the problem with sanctions, is that there is actually, because of the overuse and the overcompliance of it, and the fact that it has become such a risk factor for businesses, it actually pretty much across the board ends up functioning like comprehensive sanctions, no matter where you're looking at.
I mean, on the BRICS, I don't know what they're going to achieve, but I can say the sort of the attention you're getting exactly goes to this larger and larger number of countries who want to trade with one another, trying to find a way around the international economic system. So that's where its importance is. You have sanctioned countries, unsanctioned countries in there, and that's essentially being positioned as a way in which to create a bloc that can work with one another in the existing international economic order, in which not only Iran but Russia and increasingly China are coming under certain kinds of sanctions. So that's the significance of it in the long term. On I mean, the issues you raise are actually pretty interesting. I mean, Iran's strategy of having survived sanctions and maximum pressure sanctions is partly economic self-reliance, and partly is becoming even more aggressive than before, because becoming more aggressive is both a form of deterrence against further sanctions and is also a leverage to actually negotiate. So, you know, if having this little bit of a nuclear issue puts you under maximum pressure, then maybe you should have this much nuclear program, because that might deter the US from attacking you. And then it also, if when you go to the table, you have a lot more to negotiate with. So the strategy is to sort of double down, which is not good. Secondly, self-reliance is not necessarily good. Is actually, Iran is over self-reliant in certain things. Like, it tries to grow all of its own food, by and large, which means the country is actually running out of water. Yes, it's good that it has its economy survived, but it's producing a lot of things it should not be producing, right? It's not an efficient economy. There is no question that Iran's economy is impoverished. There's no question that Iran as a country, given its human capital, which everybody knows about, given its material capital, is underperforming on a massive scale. I mean, its GDP should be orders of magnitude larger than the entire Middle East put together, even if you excluded oil. So it's surviving, yes, they can take a price for that. But this is not an economic model that a country should actually be aspiring to. It's not something the Chinese aspire to or the Russians aspire to. And yes, it's a choice that obviously the outside world thinks that Iran's leadership makes, but it's also a condition that is imposed on Iran by the economic circumstances that they're in. And I, again, going back to the argument I made about this, Nobel laureates' argument, you know, what makes me very sad about Iran is that I think that increasingly the balance between state and society has been completely lost, right? That the balance between private sector and the state has been completely lost. And to be hopeful for me as a social scientist about a positive outcome to democracy, capitalism in Iran in my lifetime, it's just, it's the sanctions has basically reformatted the institutional makeup of Iran in a way that it's difficult to see, you know, how this will end up in an open society. So there is a cost. It's not like that you've survived sanctions. It is without a cost to a country and where it's heading, and particularly a cost to its people, which is also important to note.
I'll just say something quickly on the BRICS, because I think there's a lot of hype oftentimes in the media about the BRICS. The BRICS is not yet a thing. And I think, just to echo Vali, it can become a thing. And countries like the Islamic Republic that is contained and doesn't have a dynamic set of strong diplomatic ties looks to an institution like the BRICS to try to forge stronger economic and security ties. And that's where it can become important if the BRICS develop mechanisms to facilitate trade that and that would be helpful for a country like Iran. It's the same like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's currently like a nebulous security gathering that does really not function in any way. But just the fact that all these countries get together, you know, raises a lot of alarm in Western capitals. But there hasn't been a way of trying to present alternatives. And that is, again, an opportunity for Iran.
Great, thanks. So we're in a race against time. Let me just, okay, the lady in white, yeah, and then I'll take two more after that.
Hey, my name is Noah. I'm a student in the Department of International Relations. I was just wondering, since you were saying like the U.S. is starting to have conversations about the effectiveness of sanctions, and since I think most of the sanctions are justified by and related to Iran's nuclear project. I was wondering if, since you were saying in the near future, probably Iran will be a nuclear power, if this might be a change, like if you see in this some possibility to sanction lifting in the sense that it will enforce like the U.S. to, I mean, change the discussions around the sanctions or change the goals that they put onto themselves in relation to sanctions.
We have one question in front by the gentleman.
I
think we'll need a microphone, sorry.
It's coming.
My name is Hamid Hakimzadeh. You've described how sanctions have been around for a long time, how they work, and rather how they don't work, and their impact on the civilian population of those countries, Iran in particular, and the rise of the military and political class. So the effect that you describe is not new. It's been around, it's been observed for a very long time, and yet you speak as if the people in Langley or Foggy Bottom or wherever they sit were just beginning to realize this, as if they weren't aware of the consequences of the dynamic of these sanctions. I find that very difficult to believe. I think they know these situations, so there is some other, perhaps iconography, for them to demonstrate to the world at large what it means for you as a society, you as a regime, to stand up against the international order. This is what we'll do with you. wants to carry more than that. But could you address why there is this discrepancy between such a glaring reality in front of our eyes and this almost pretense as if something else is happening?
Thank you. And then the gentleman in the back, yes, yes, I think blue t-shirt potentially, yeah.
Hello, my name is Max. I'm a student getting my master's in politics and economics in the Middle East at King's College. I guess my question is more, you talked about sort of how politicians or statecrafters have viewed sanctions as both sort of a continuation or an extension of war, and I do think sort of with that development there's also been sort of this distinction of sanctions as opposed to boots on the ground war. But could you also talk about sort of the development of this disconnect maybe with state makers and sort of the general populace, and how maybe boots on the ground war is seen much more as a humanitarian issue than sanctions are? And I know you talked about sort of developing imagery and developing sort of educational and informational teachings in order to sort of expand this understanding. But can you talk maybe where that sort of disconnect really stems from?
Okay. So the question on sanctions lifting, I mean, when we had a convening last week on the question of economic, can sanctions be reformed? One of our speakers, who's actually a faculty member at Hopkins, he used to be a, he used to be the director of OFAC, which is the this office in the Department of Treasury in charge of sanctions, right? And he said when someone asked him about this Russia sanctions and said, you know, when do you think the Russia sanctions will be lifted? This was like a business client was asking him for advice. And he said to his client, when your grandchildren are dead, these sanctions are still going to be there. Okay. And to me, it points to there is no such thing as sanctions lifting. So even if it's not on Iran's nuclear issue, it will be on another issue. And those, even the nuclear issue sanctions will continue to be there. Because as Vadi said, there literally are no mechanisms for sanctions lifting. Even when Serbia, and this is actually something that is talked about and studied quite a bit in policy circles inside Iran, even when Serbia had regime change, right? Like they got a new regime, still, it took years for those sanctions to be lifted, in because they kept raising the bar on the things that needed to be met before those sanctions were lifted under a new kind of political establishment. So sanctions, and this is the core fundamental problem of sanctions, is that there is no mechanism for lifting them. Which brings me to your excellent question. First of all, I want to answer this question in two quick ways because I know we're tight on time. One is to say that I am constantly surprised at how much one would think that things should be obvious in Washington and yet they are not. So that's on the one hand. Sometimes I feel like I'm living in La La Land. On the other hand, though, it's sort of more pertinent to the essential critique you're making here. I want to one day write a much different kind of book, which is beginning to look at sanctions actually from the example of Haiti and the Haitian Revolution from a few hundred years ago. And that gets to what you're saying, which is that economic penalty for countries that attempt to, whether you agree with them or not, but attempt to have politics that go against the dominant sort of Western world, are the economic penalty is dealt to them, whether it's, you know, the ridiculousness of the French saying Haiti has to pay us reparations for the colony rather than vice versa, to all the way to the Cuba example is the number one example, I think, that anyone who ever looks at sanctions and the question of the humanitarian impact should be able to understand. If you've ever been there or even haven't been there and can just look at it through pictures and videos, that 60 years of sanctions has not led to regime change in Cuba and has only devastated the Cuban population, but yet it doesn't go anywhere. And much of it is to make an example to the rest of Latin America that if you dare to say we will not be a part of the US's backyard, we will make our own decisions, you're going to come under some form of these kinds of consequences. So there very much is that that thing to your critique. But the way that it becomes more complicated is that now that the United States is sanctioning bigger economies, it's starting to have this blowback effect that begins to complicate that question a little bit, which is that it is so addicted to it at this stage that it is beginning to have repercussions for the dollar supremacy and then more broadly sort of US geopolitics or imperial politics, however you want to define them. And then the last question on the humanitarian disconnect. The way that I would answer that is, look, I think that as citizens of these countries, we need to be able to understand what our foreign policy is doing. However, as we see very clearly, even when we understand and even when we can see it, like right now what's going on in Gaza and elsewhere, and we have opinions about it and you march on the street for it, it does not actually change foreign policy, right? So the question of foreign policy and the question of sort of democratic decision-making are actually not linked, and that is a much deeper conversation that we need to be having as societies. And so as an educator, as an anthropologist, I think it's important for us to talk about these things. I will go to the grave dying sort of talking about these issues and saying that we need to talk about them. But the very real reality of power right now is that there is not a one-to-one connect. So, and the other part of this is that because of the vagueness of sanctions, policymakers can say things like, well, okay, but we do have a humanitarian ability that you can send pharmaceutical goods, or you have a humanitarian sort of exception to these sanctions. But as we've talked about before, when you sanction to the ways that you have, there actually is no such humanitarian exception at all in any country that you're looking at.
Just very quickly, only to your point, he's probably the argument that if you don't play by the rules of the United States, et cetera, so the United States says, okay, then you cannot have access to the dollar system, which is my system, until such time that you agree to behave like everybody else, is more understandable. But when we have a very specific thing we want from a country, like you need to withdraw from Ukraine, or you need to cashier your nuclear issue, then it's much more should be a transactional kind of a foreign policy discussion. And that is where perhaps is the greatest amount of problem. But you know, the question you make that they ought to know, actually it's a very interesting question, and I don't have a good answer for you. I mean, I can say there's a difference between professional bureaucrats and politicians, but I'm actually shocked always in Washington at how quickly knowledge is lost. I mean, you know, Israel is entering into a war in Lebanon, and the dearth of knowledge about 1982 and its outcome among the political class in Washington is just staggering. I mean, the one person probably remembers is senile, but everybody else is just sort of was born after, doesn't remember, or how much, for instance, what lessons did we learn from sanctions in Iraq? Even on the very basic argument that when you go to maximum amount of sanctions is not a substitute for war, it's a path to war. Because in the end, the sanctions in Iraq did not avert war. Sanctions never toppled Saddam Hussein. It never got to where we wanted. We in the end had to invade. It cost us trillions of dollars. And so even if you put that argument on the table, yes, everything is bad with Iran, but you have to realize that the pathway you're going is going to end up with March 2003 being repeated. And last time with Iraq, you spent X amount of money, and it wasn't a very happy outcome. This is a country orders of magnitude larger. If this was actually military planning, your generals would sort of say, let me wait and think, is there a way of adjusting the strategy? But none exists. That kind of unbelievably sort of self-consciousness about how these policies have worked is lacking. And I really don't have a good answer to why is that the case, that we're sort of marching down this path without actually questioning. I mean, particularly with Russia, everything we know about what's happened with Iran should tell us that Putin will not go out of Ukraine because of sanctions. It's going to become a far more aggressive, dangerous, hardline, authoritarian country that is going to be a much, much bigger pain for Europe. I don't know if there's another way, but we ought to say at least the example of Iran should tell you that it's more likely than not that Russia will be far worse down the road than when it went to Ukraine. So you know, our hope is to sort of force this conversation, not to say that there's a solution here, but you know, the way we're using sanctions without any kind of self-reflection is not going to be good for Europe or the US.
Great. Sanctions are permanent, but the event unfortunately is almost over, so I can take one last question from the back. Yeah, you were quick enough. It better be a good question.
No pressure.
And then we'll get some very crisp answers. Just in the meantime, while the microphone travels over there, remind you that all the answers to all the questions that you couldn't ask are in this book, yeah, which you'll be purchasing outside of the doors of this room in a few minutes. Yes, please.
Well, you have to shout.
You can shout.
It better be good. my name is Johnny Dorey. I'm a former acolyte of St. Anne's at SICE, PhD students at Sussex. My question is about Israel and sanctions in Israel. It occurs to me that it's an interesting empirical exception. So to throw that stick into your theoretical scope, if you will, the US appears to have sanctioned one of its core allies. Now, recently been concerned with some domestic work about sanctions lodging in Israel by these entities, South Asia, and all these groups in the West Bank. I wondered if the panel could respond to that, the theoretical concept of sanctions in Israel, and particularly given that you've conducted so much ethnographic fieldwork in this field site.
So just by way of background and to clarify, this is about sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on some radical settler leaders and on a specific military unit related to that. Is that correct? Is that what you're alluding to? Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. This is actually a great question. So oftentimes South Africa is brought up as like the exception to the sanctions case, right? Like South Africa is the case where sanctioned works. Now, those who study South Africa will always tell you that it's much more complicated than that. But what you can point to is that countries that are already within the Western economic system and are allies to the United States and major European powers, when there is a threat of sanctions or some sanctions that are imposed on them, then the hurt from those sanctions actually does end up producing some kind of behavioral change, okay? Which is different than a country that's already been isolated out of the Western economic system. Now, from everything that I've read and Israeli scholars I've spoken to, these kinds of sanctions at the moment are actually not really work. They're not implemented. It's more just to like as a concession that the Biden administration again kind of did as rhetorically in order to say that we're doing something when the heat got higher last year in the United States politically. But the other side of your question is the parallel between Palestinian civil society asking for and putting forward BDS or boycott, divestment, and sanctions as a way to pressure the Israeli state. And what they are sort of pulling on is the ANC example in South Africa and saying that the activist network in South Africa and their allies abroad eventually put enough pressure for sanctions to be implemented on the South African case, helping other things that eventually dismantled apartheid. That is a very interesting case to look at and to consider. It's very different from the kinds of sanctions we're talking about, because the kinds of sanctions we're talking about are ones that are imposed from the top down on adversarial nations. These kinds of sanctions, if they ever go into effect or if they increase, it's not feasible that the United States will ever rhetorically make Israel a pariah state so that sanctions can be imposed on it. That is much more of like a South African case where it needs to be pressure from the bottom up, like activist networks, civil society networks that make any kind of dealings with Israel a headache for businesses. And so it's a different calculus. But in the United States, at least, in over 30 states, BDS is illegal, right? So it is a very different kind of political environment, mainly because they learned from the South Africa case. And so activists and even in certain states like Texas, when you're gonna get employed, you sign a contract, and in that contract, it says that you will not engage in these kinds of activities. So it's a very complicated case.
Molly, any? Sana?
Yeah.
Well, before we thank the speakers, I think there should be a slide now, if the technology is working, showing the upcoming events at the IR department and the Middle East Center. So please have a look at those and come to those. Other than that, the only thing I'd like to do is to ask you to join me in thanking our great panelists for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.